I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I say good evening. It could be any time of day when you're listening to this. Any time, any place, anywhere. That's the beauty of podcasts, isn't it? Conversations on the go. Introductions to said conversations on the go as well. This intro comes to you live from a hotel room in Poland. My friends, I've been in Poland this weekend for another round of Hot Wheels Monster Trucks Live. I'm training European hosts throughout mainland Europe to do the show in all their local languages. And it's both challenging and rewarding in equal measures. The shows are massive and amazing and intense and just joyous. I think that's the main thing that I love about this gig is it's so outside of the rock and roll stuff that I've done my whole life, which is always to adult crowds, and I'm now working in this environment where you're entertaining kids and you're just spreading joy, and it's such a wholesome and enriching experience. And yeah, I'm just super grateful for the opportunity. So thank you to Hot Wheels, who will probably never hear this Sammy Yaffa podcast because it could not be further from that brand. But I like to stretch both sides. I like to express the full range of my skill set and interest. This week's conversation is with one of the true icons of rock and roll. For me, they don't come any cooler than this guy. He looks cool, he acts cool, he is cool, and he's just a really decent, down-to-earth, lovely guy as well. Sammy Yaffa from Hanoi Rocks joins me on the show this week. If you are not down, if you are not familiar with the band Hanoi Rocks and you like rock and roll music, then you need this band in your life. They are one of the most underrated and influential and downright awesome rock and roll bands to ever do it. If you like Guns N' Roses, if you like Aerosmith, if you like Ramones, if you like The Damned, if you like The Helicopters, Backyard Babies, Wild Hearts, etc., if you like all those bands, you'll probably already know and love Hanoi Rocks. But for those who don't, get to know, because these guys are the guys. And Sammy Yaffa was the bassist in that band of Misfits. That's the band he cut his teeth and explored and experienced the world and all the highs and lows and trials and tribulations of life that young rock and rollers get to go through, at least back in that crazy halcyon time of CD sales and drugs and chaos. And all of it's documented in Sammy's brilliant book, which I highly recommend. It's called The Road Bends, and it's available via the very same publishers who released my two books, Life in the Stocks, Volumes 1 and 2. So why not pick up my two books and Sammy's book whilst you're at it? So many great rock and roll stories in Sammy's book. He's lived it. He's lived the life, and he's still doing it, and he's still writing and releasing kick-ass rock and roll music as well. He had a debut solo album out back in 2021, which I listened to ahead of this conversation and loved. And we talk all about it. The album is called The Innermost Journey to Your Outermost Mind, which is such a great kind of 60s psychedelic rock and roll album title. And that theme is very much carried on to his brand new second solo album, which I didn't even know he had in the works. And between when we did the conversation you're about to hear and now, this album just came out of nowhere, and I was like, oh my God, I didn't even know. We didn't even get the chance to talk about it. I've still not heard it, but I've just downloaded it on my phone, and I'm going to listen to it during my 10-hour train ride from Poland to Amsterdam tomorrow, and I can't wait. The album cover looks like a Sergio Leone spaghetti western film set in space, but the title, get this, is Satan's Helpers, War Laser Eyes, and the Money Pig Circus. If that isn't the best album title I've ever heard, I don't know what is, so I cannot wait to dive into that on the train ride tomorrow. But yeah, check out Sammy's debut and second solo albums. Check out his book, The Road Bends. And if you're not already familiar, please just download and absorb and enjoy the entire Hanoi Rocks back catalogue, because it is so damn good. And that's without even mentioning the other bands that Sammy's played in over the years, from the New York Dolls to Joan Jett and the Black Hearts. And he's still out there right now with his former Hanoi Rocks bandmate, with Michael Monroe, who is also a previous guest on this show, playing bass in the Michael Monroe Band, who are one of the best last great old school rock and roll bands around. You won't see many bands like that still doing it. And these guys, my friend Rich Jones plays in the band as well, these guys are so damn good. It is a guaranteed good time every time. So if you ever get the chance to see the Michael Monroe Band live, do it. There's nothing else I really want to say. I just want to jump straight into this conversation now. And I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Sammy is just an awesome dude, and I'm super happy that we finally got to line up the stars and have him on the show. So without further ado, here is episode 318 of Life in the Stocks with Sammy Yaffa. Enjoy.
Where the hell have you been? Who let you in? You got a hole in your head. I'm going back to bed. This will be the last time, the very first last time. I know I need to choose. This will be the last time, the very first last time. I'm not gonna lose.
Hey, can you hear me now?
Boom, yeah, I can hear you. We have
all audio. Right, this has been quite a trip. Hold on 1 second. I'm trying to get there. Now there should be camera.
Fuck yeah, we're in business.
Oh boy, man. I did a Zoom yesterday and nothing wrong whatsoever. No, I came to the computer and the computer was shut down, and I didn't shut it down. It shut it by itself. So maybe it did some kind of a automatic freaking reboot or something. Who knows? But here we are.
Well, here we are. And you know what, Sammy? It was well worth the wait, because you look as dapper as always. So I'm pleased. I'm pleased that it came off. And, and we're joined by a canine companion on the show today as well.
That's Bubble. That's my dog.
We've had a couple of pets on the show in the past, but they've never appeared from the very start. They've always kind of appeared halfway through or somewhere along the way.
Yeah, this will be here more or less the whole thing. Yeah.
Was it a girl? Sorry, did you say?
Yes.
Yeah. She is eager. And she's also brought you a shoe by the looks of it, mate.
Yeah, it's a bottom of a shoe or something. You know, this is usually the thing what happens. It's interviews. It's I'm holding on to a wet bone.
Well, dude, there's very much no rules or restrictions here. So any gonzo ingredients thrown in the mix along the way is welcome. Where you are, I know you're in Spain, but it really does look like you're in Spain. It looks like one of those spaghetti western kind of villas from a Sergio Leone movie. Yeah, it looks like a beautiful place.
It's like a 100-year-old country place, and it's in Mallorca in the middle of the island.
Wow.
Yeah.
So is that one of your home? Is that your main home? Is that your
base? Yeah, so we live here and in Helsinki, so we try to be here as much as possible, especially in the winter.
Well, other than the beautiful food, the beautiful weather, and the beautiful people, What brought you to that part of the world?
I've been coming here since early 80s. My sister moved here in 82 and married a Spanish guy and had a couple of kids. And, you know, it just became another home. And I moved here right after Hanoi. I spent some months over here. And then in the 90s, I lived here for a couple of years. And now I moved here in 2014. So it's been 10 years again.
Love it. And so I know you're a very well-traveled man. I want to talk to you about travel today, but do you find as someone myself who's been going through big life changes over the last few months, and I've been doing that in different locations, kind of processing the growth, have you found in your life that you've come to associate certain periods of your life and of growth and experience with certain locations? And when you go back there, do you have an emotional anchor with that place? Does it kind of center and ground you in a positive way? Or indeed the flip side, do you have kind of crazy associative memories with other places? Like, do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. London is one, like passing by King's Cross kind of makes me cringe. you're totally right. A lot of these places, I lived in a lot of places. I lived in New York for 25 years. I lived in LA for 3 years. I lived in London for 2-3 years, and Spain now for a while, and Stockholm, Sweden, and Finland. So they all have kind of a special place, you know what I mean? It's every time when I go back to any of these places, it's kind of like a flood of memories and friends and all this kind of stuff. So yeah, you're totally right.
It's beautiful, man. Like, you know, the more you travel, I think the more you experience life and in all its richness and variety and wonder. And obviously from the get-go, really, like, what age did you leave home for the first time and kind of just get out in the world?
16.
Wow.
Yeah, that was, I mean, I started touring with that band before Hanoi Rocks, where I met Andy. It was Pelle Miljoona. I started playing with them when I was 16, and we were in that band for like 9 months, and then we moved to Sweden, you know, with the band, and I started doing it for reals. And yeah, so it's been a little bit of a trip.
Now, were you guys in Hanoi, because, you know, you experienced so many formative character building, challenging, I'm sure, chaotic, I know, moments, milestones together. Do you think you're the kind of guys that would have been friends had it not been for that, you know, just band experience, like the universe bringing you together to create music? Did you share common interests and like, you know, were you close during those formative years as people, as kids?
Yeah, we were very close. We were all very close to each other and everybody, you know, we're very close with, you know, I would hang out with Nasty Russell one day and with Michael the other and Andy the other, and they would do the same. And, you know, and then we had the business with the band and all that. You know, we're very close and kind of living in that little bubble, because we're a bunch of Finns, you know, from, you know, that just landed in London and this kind of stuff. So we kind of kept it together.
Yeah, I think there's definitely something to be said for being outsiders together, right? Like, you know, it's one thing being a misfit on your own, but when there's a little group of you and you all feel a similar sense of perhaps disalignment with everything else around you,
does it
bond you in a really kind of fierce way? Because it's like us against the world mentality.
Yeah, it's kind of nuts when one is crazier than the other, you know what I mean? It was just like feeding the beast for 5 years, you know what I mean?
Were you all of a similar age? Were you all like kids?
Yeah, it's just a 1 year age difference, except for Razzle. He was a few years older. Yeah, a couple of years older.
And were you all living on the streets for a time? Am I right in thinking that before you got to London? Or is that kind
of thing? Basically me and Nasty and Michael were stomping the, you know, pavement. You know, I never walked so much in my life than not having a home, you know. So that lasted for about maybe 8 months, 9 months or something like that. And then we finally got a roof over our heads. And, you know,
it was all luxury. In Stockholm as well.
Yeah, like in the winter and the fall. It was kind of harsh.
Yeah, cold as fuck.
Yeah, exactly.
I guess when you're young, there is a kind of a fearlessness, whether it's stupidity, I don't know. There's a courageous, fearless, relentless pursuit of your dreams and of whatever it is, right? You kind of don't give a shit about personal safety and hurdles in the way. It's kind of just, you know, caution to the wind and let's get at it, isn't it?
Yeah, it's exactly that. It's, I don't know what it is, but nothing else really matters. You know, it's just, we were on a common mission and, you know, we were us against the world and, you know, fuck the system and, you know, and be yourself. And no matter what anybody says, it was our thing and all that. It was definitely that. When you're young, you know, that's how you're supposed to be, I think.
Yeah. And so I hope you don't mind me asking this, but were drugs an immediate introduction into the mix, or did that come a little later on, or was it all at once?
They came on very early on, you know, but it was more like smoking a little and doing a lot of speed, you know, that was and drinking, you know. But it wasn't really that harmful for the first couple of years. Then the harder stuff came in, and then it just kind of like, yeah, it wasn't good.
Now, was there a lot of that stuff in Scandinavia, or was it more, because you're saying earlier on in King's Cross is where you cringe, was it when you got to London that...
Yeah, it was exactly. It was like the amphetamines were in Scandinavia and the harder stuff was in London. And yeah, that's where we got into it. Oh, they have this and it's very easy to find.
And are you so, again, I'm going to ask you stuff. If you don't want to answer it, you can skirt around it. But everyone who I know who's done heroin was always intrigued by it. And they were always perhaps slightly fascinated by the darkness, the mystery.
Yeah.
The allure that comes with it. I don't know many people who kind of just stumbled into it and, you know, accidentally found themselves a heroin addict. Like, was it something for you that presented this rock and roll mystique?
Yeah, it has that kind of mystery to it. You know, William Burroughs, and you know, I read all those books, you know, when I was a kid. And, you know, it has this certain kind of thing. And then when you kind of like first time try it and you're not addicted, so you think, like, oh, fuck's the big deal? And you know, it takes a while to get into that thing, but yeah, I'm just glad that it's over.
Fucking A. Well, not many people get off it, do they? Not many successfully do. So
yeah,
kudos first and foremost for, you know, changing the narrative and
yeah,
not becoming, you know, dead or in jail as so many
so many
do. But I think there's kind of, again, with rock and roll specifically at that time, it was just a wash, wasn't it? It was everywhere, and it was almost encouraged and certainly romanticized.
Yeah, it was almost like an epidemic in London in the early 80s, and in Spain it was you know, almost as easy as get your hands on to, like, you know, a little bit of weed or something. It was like oversaturated, the whole market over there. It was very sad. People were dropping like flies, and it was just a horrible time in that perspective.
Mm. Well, you know, I think London can be, especially then, a pretty fucking gritty city as well. Like as young kids coming there, was it a culture shock? Were you like, oh my God, where have we landed? You're obviously familiar with the music and the culture coming out of there, but the culture itself, the street culture, the pub culture, how did you respond?
We embraced it wholeheartedly. It was really, really great. I came to London that summer before, you know, we started. I know when I was 16, I got a little bit of money and I just wanted to go and see a bunch of punk rock, and, you know, ended up in this 100 club kind of festival with Anti-Nowhere League and Anti-Pasty and Exploited and all this, which is scary as fuck. It was so, oh my God, where am I, man? You know, because punk was kind of like in a smaller scale in Scandinavia. It was just fucking crazy, crazy gig. And I remember going to, of course, I had to, you know, make the pilgrimage to Water Street, to Marquee. And I went over there and it said on the door that tonight it's rockabilly from Long Island, USA, the Stray Cats.
Hell yeah.
This is in 1980. And I was just so sick of fucking rockabilly because it had been the biggest kind of music and youth movement in Finland for the past 3 years. You know, it was just all about crazy cave and rhythm rockers and Matchbox and Gene Vincent and, you know, great music. But I was just, I come to London, I have to go check out freaking rockabilly. And I decided to walk in there anyway. And they just blew my mind. It was still like one of the best girl concerts I've ever seen. And I became friends with Slim Jim, you know, with the drummer, and he told me that it was probably one of their first or the second gig that they did.
Wow.
Coming off the boat from New York to London to make it. And it was cool. It was definitely amazing.
Well, you touch on something there that I wanted to get into with you, because I know punk rock is a huge influential force in your musical life, in your, you know, just life in general. But for me, rock and roll music, right? an emphasis on the role. Rock and roll music is at the center of everything you do. And for me, there's not that many bands that embody rock and roll. Plenty of rock bands.
Yeah.
Plenty of rock bands. But to have the role and the, you know, the sound as well, we're talking Little Richard, we're talking the Rolling Stones, we're talking the Ramones, we're talking Motorhead, we're definitely talking Hanoi Rocks. That's such an interesting thing for me, because so many people all the time talk about rock and rock, but that role word, I think, often gets overlooked. I'd love to get into a little bit of that with you. Like, very early on, was it all about the swagger and the groove and the rhythm and the cool, as well as it was, you know, the riff and the distortion and the volume and all of that?
Yeah, it's definitely, it's as you said, it's like the rock and roll, it's round. You know? And then at some point, you know, I think it came with metal, you know, it became kind of square, where everything is very precise and you forget about the kind of the groove aspect of rock music. And I think that's always been essential. It's I'm not a big metal fan just because of that reason. You know what I mean? I don't find much groove in it. And it just becomes boring to me at some point. You know what I mean? I mean, there's exceptions like Slayer. You know, Slayer has a fucking groove. You know, they're amazing. I saw them live a couple of times, and it's just mind-boggling. You know, but most of these kind of, you know, boxy kind of bands, they are rock bands.
Well, even if you look at headbanging as a reaction to the movement, right? It's like very rigid and kind of just like on the beat. You know, there's no flailing the arms and kind of like. Yeah. When I saw you guys live, it was, I guess, January 2022, around that time, I think. It was when it was Black Star Riders, Michael Monroe Band, and Phil Campbell and the Bastard Sons. And this is one of the very few times in my life I've gone to a show and loved it so much, I like went to the next date on the tour. I just had to go. And it was because of you guys. Like, I love Ricky, love Black Star Riders. That's why I was there, was to photograph them. But watching, and I've known Rich Jones for years, so we're pals. So he was like, you can photograph us as well. And so I photographed the whole set. And I just had such a good time right there in the pit, right up close, watching you all. Just like, there's so few rock and roll bands that bring it like that. And I was like, I've got to come the next night. And so I came to London as well. I wasn't going to come to the London show, but I came and caught the last day as well, because I was just fucking blown away by how much fun and how like tight, but also loose and in the pocket and in the groove you guys are as a band. And it's such a phenomenal force. I loved it. I can't say enough good things about that band and the energy that it brings, the swagger, the attitude. Like, it's there, isn't it, in spades.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, absolutely, man. That's what we're all about. It's not too like that. It's it has a freedom. It has it twitches and it's elastic. You know, that's what I like about it. It's elastic. Our band is very elastic, and we're a very good can-can troupe as well.
Yeah, you are. Yeah, there you are.
Watch out.
Which is very important. Very important when it comes to the rock and the roll.
Yeah.
And dude, I've just been checking out your solo album as well. And so on there, there's reggae, there's the Rotten Root song. There's a song that sounds like it could be on like a new ZZ Top album, I Can't Stand It.
Yeah.
That kind of sounds like that I Got to Get Paid, you know, newer era ZZ Top kind of swamp groove rock. There's a tune which reminds me of Gogo Bordello on there and The Clash. And then there's obviously kind of Stooges style rock and roll. Like, it's all there. And I love that, because without any disrespect to certain people within your musical world ecosystem, if you will, a lot of them just only do the kind of street rock and roll, right? And that's it. And that's great. But it's clear to me that you are a man with many feathers to your cap. And the street rock and roll is definitely a key component, but then there is all this other great stuff as well.
Yeah, I always looked at music that it shouldn't have any boundaries. And that's, you know, I was a teenager when Clash came out, you know, it had a huge impact on me. It really did. It just kind of opened up my eyes on everything. You know, Pistols was great. I love Never Mind the Bollocks. It's still like, where the fuck did that record come from kind of experience every time you listen to it. But it was kind of like one trick pony, you know, compared to like the Clash's thing. And also what you could actually say in lyrics, in lyrical content, and use different influences. It just kind of formed me that I always thought that that's the way bands should be. And And we kind of had that with Hanoi as well. We did a lot of all kinds of different things. I mean, you know, Malibu Beach Nightmare was originally a Calypso song. You know, I mean, it was done in overtime in a studio. We had nothing else to do. And, you know, it turned into this, you know, kind of like classic tune.
Is the guitar motif in that, is that a little nod to the Sex Pistols with a
the Anaconda? Oh, yeah, yeah. It is, oh, yeah. Hell yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. So we peppered with that stuff, you know.
Yeah.
I was a big fan of Mott the Hoople and all this kind of stuff. So you can hear Ariel Bender on his guitar playing and this kind of stuff. So
I heard somewhere or read somewhere you were saying in one interview that the London Calling record, that's your favorite album ever, right?
Yeah. Yeah. If I had to choose one, yeah. If I really had to choose one, I mean, there's an amazing amount of great records, but if I had to choose one, yeah, that's, I can listen to that thing forever. You know, it's a trippy thing.
Yeah, so special, man. Even when you get like into the middle and the later end of the record, and you've got like Coca-Cola and Card Cheat, and you know, just like, again, it's rock and roll. There's real Americana influences in there. There's world influences from all over the place. You know, all of it in its spirit is punk. But like, you know, I met a guy once down the pub when I was younger, and he was like, the only good Clash record's the first record. It went downhill after that. And it's that classic punk mentality that, like, you know, just needs to be like fucking UK subs or it's out.
Yeah.
I was like, well, you know, rules and rigid kind of formulaic thinking like that isn't very punk rock, but okay. But that London Calling record is just this sprawling, beautiful, and it's not messy either. You know, it doesn't lose its trajectory or its focus.
Yeah. Like,
it's sprawling and it's epic, but it's still cohesive and you know, packs a fucking punch every step of the way. Doesn't it?
Absolutely. It's the production on that is timeless. You know, it doesn't grow old. It's just very well put together record. And I remember when I first put it on, what kind of impact it had. It was little like, what the fuck is happening? You know, and I was what, 15 then. You know, it was a big record.
Well, Paul Simonon,
when I ran into Paul Simonon, you know, it just happenstance in New York, like, I don't know, 8 years, 9 years ago or something. You know, it just happened to be leaving a restaurant and sitting at the bar having a last drink, and then some friends came in and started introducing me, and then there's this tall person there, and this is Paul, and then I look up and it's fucking Simonon. I lost my shit. I don't usually lose my shit. I just went like, oh my fucking God.
You know? Love that.
Very, very nice man, seemed to be. Very nice.
You know, you've obviously jammed and created with some of the most iconic people in that world. So it's lovely to hear that there are still those select few that you still revert back to being like. And Michael's that way too. I've spoken to Michael, and I mean, he's like a big kid when he sees bands that he loves. Like he has no shame in expressing.
There's no filter. There's nothing. It's just all out.
I actually watched. We did a podcast together, like, man, 4 or 5 years ago. It was ages ago, and we went to see Cheap Trick together that night after doing the interview. And he almost jumped up on the table at one point. It was at the Forum in London. We were up on the balcony. We had a little table area. And he was like, yeah, he was almost jumping on the table with excitement, just like, you know, with his fan out, just so, so stoked. And I was like, man, this is so reassuring and inspiring to see that that connection to the music, if you really love it, never goes.
Oh, hell yeah. Yep. He is like that. He's a, you know, Ritalin kid. He's crazy. I fucking love him. There's no filter. It just goes for it. You know, just pure energy.
Does he ever switch off? Does he ever slow down?
Yeah, not enough.
I can imagine it's exhausting. You know, it's charming.
Looking at him, he was just tired. I was like, oh my God, I got to go take a nap. You know?
Yeah, there's someone who doesn't need drugs, and I don't know if he was always.
No. Thank God he stopped.
Was he always that way? Was he always just full energy?
He's been special. He's been touched, as he says himself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so the you know, the five of you, the four of you, the core guys, like, over the years, you know, and history comes with baggage. It comes with friction. You know, it comes with so much trial and tribulation, but are all of you remaining fairly on good terms throughout the years, or are there definite moments where there is real voids and real resentment? And
we stay tight, you know. There's, we have the problem child in our family, but you know, he behaves every now and then, so we can hang out with him every now and then too.
But in small doses.
Small doses, exactly. And, you know, but we, you know, care about each other. It's we became bros, if you want to call it that. You know, during those years, they were very important to us. And even though it ended tragically, and everybody kind of like went their own ways to, I think, to deal with the trauma. And, you know, some people dealt with, you know, their own way. But still, every time, you know, we are in town or anything happens, we usually get in touch. And, you know, I know me and Michael, we've been doing this band now for 14 years, you know, so me and him are constantly in touch. And Nasty shows up on our gigs and he plays on my new record and all that. And we did Michael's 60th birthday at a Hanoi reunion with Andy. And we've done a couple of Pele Miliona reunions, which is the band that Andy and I were before, which is kind of a big punk band in Finland, you know, late 70s, early 80s. And we've done a couple of those. So I've been touring with the guy. And, you know, it's all good in the hood, as they say.
I love it. And I think what's really cool, and, you know, you can shed some light on this, but I know there was a time when Michael reformed with different people and kept it going for a bit. But for the large part, it does seem like the legacy of that band has been kept intact. And it's like, we did it. We left our mark and let's leave it in the past. Let's not keep digging it up and going back and, you know, reforming, reuniting. Like, and I love that because you're one of the very, very, very few bands that has not been tempted by the money, by whatever it is. Like, there seems to be this sense with all of you that it's just like, we're proud of what we did with that band. Let's leave that legacy there and not keep revisiting it when it doesn't maybe need to. Like, we said what we said and we moved on.
Yeah, exactly. It's like that reunion thing of Michael's birthday was always meant to be just a one-off, just as a, you know.
Well, you're only 60 once, aren't you?
Huh?
You're only 60 once.
Oh, yeah, exactly. You know, and then it was like we all just came together for Michael. You know what I mean? It was very, very cool. It was great. It was, you know, everybody was kind of like walking a little bit above the ground, you know, during that day and those rehearsals and having Chip there, you know, the original drummer. And it's funny, kind of, you know, the band dynamics and how people are with each other, it hasn't really changed. It's still just as crazy and chaotic and nuts and, you know, insulting and whatever you want to call it. You know what I mean? It's really funny. I had a great time doing that and playing those songs, you know, with him, with the band. You know, it was just a freaking blast. You know, and I never say never. You know, you never know. You know, if somebody throws us a huge load of cash, we might say, fuck off, or we might say, give me the money. I'm ready to retire, man.
That's it. I don't want to do any more tours.
I doubt it. It's that horse has been ridden, you know what I mean? It's Andy and Michael reformed it kind of, even though to me it didn't have much similarities with the original Hanoi. It's kind of like lost its something. And I think it's just better like this.
Well, you guys are real rock and rollers as well. You know, you're not in it. I don't think any of you are. Anyway, you don't strike me as the kind of people that are, because many people, I think, who become successful in their bands switch somewhere along the way from musicians and artists to businessmen. And cash becomes the primary incentive. Whereas real rock and roll bands, and not to kind of, you know, introduce that hierarchical system into conversation, but like, let's be real, there are some that are authentic and there are some that are not. And you guys strike me as those that are in it for the love of the music first and foremost.
Yeah, it's absolutely. And it's kind of, I've been thinking about that. It's like the people that we most respected was kind of like, you know, the Stooges and the Damned and MC5 and, you know, pretty much, you know, not that successful bands. So we're already kind of like heading for not making, becoming a hugely successful band, because I think, you know, our heroes and the way that we thought how rock and roll is supposed to be was not really accepted by the mainstream. And the first couple of record, you know, label offers that we had in UK in like 82 or something like that, they wanted to change our name. They wanted to change our look. They wanted us to be like Duran Duran or some shit like that. And we just, you know, told them to go and leave us alone. You know, we're going to do this with our own label if need be. So it was never about the money. It was never about the, you know, it wasn't even like, of course, we wanted to be famous. So you want to make it. You want to make a living out of, you know, but when we reached the point that we had our own apartments, we thought that we were fucking kings of the world. You know what I mean? It's like we were doing great, man. You know what I mean? So it was, it's always been like that. And it hasn't really disappeared from any of us. You know, Nasty just, thank God he stopped doing what he was doing back then. And maybe it was good for him that he chose another path in life than making music. But that Nasty suicide person has never left the Jan Stenfors body. You know, every time he puts the guitar on, he turns into this beast. And it's just fucking amazing. So we've been doing these Demolition 23 reunion gigs and with Nasty on guitar, just as a support piece, just me and Michael and Nasty and Carl, you know, playing drums. And it's just fucking amazing. Love that stuff.
It was like last year, right? You did some shows in...
Yeah, in October.
Yeah, they looked amazing. My friend Rachel was out there taking some photographs, and yeah, it looked like a really good time.
Yeah.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness,
because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Is he a pharmacist now, Nasty?
Well, he's higher up than a pharmacist. He's a provisor. What do you call it? I don't know the technical term, but he's sold his soul to the big pharma, basically.
He's in the medical world. What an ironic career shift. I love
Absolutely,
it.
Absolutely, man. It's very ironic. I laughed my fucking head off when I found out.
Sometimes the truth really is stranger than fiction, isn't it?
Yeah. A little training.
Outside of those core guys, who have been some of your favorite musical collaborators over the years? Because as I alluded to earlier, you have, you know, been in bands and played with real icons of this magical world of rock and roll that we're talking about. Who for you have been the most enjoyable and inspiring to be around and play with? That's just kind of like pinch me moments almost.
Sylvain was a pinch me moment every day. That guy was... he was the sweetest man on earth, and he was a totally underrated guitar player and songwriter. It's Sylvain, and he was very humble guy and kind. And, you know, just being able to play with him for 6 years was just amazing. And of course with David too, you know, with Johansson, you know, it's like, I mean, a singer like that, it's otherworldly. You know what I mean? Yeah, those two are, you know, outside of like the Hanoi Boys, and those two have been the most influential and eye-opening and also the most fun band that I have ever been in. Actually, those 6 years was just like being on the road with Abbott and Costello or something. It was just nonstop, just giggles and laughter, good time.
There's something about those old school New York characters. They're almost, and I mean this with love, they're almost like cartoon characters, aren't they? They're so larger than life and
absolutely
out of sync with the modern world, and just like just brilliant characters that you really don't get people like that anymore. You don't run into people like that anymore. They're the last of a beautiful era of old school New York, aren't they?
Yes, disappearing breed, that's for sure.
Were you saying earlier on you lived in that city for 25 years?
Yeah, I was there about 20, 24, 25 years. I lived in Spain in the middle in the 90s for a couple of years. But otherwise, I was in New York from 1990 until 2014, 15. Yeah, over 20 years.
So you caught really, because I think for me, obviously, post 9/11, everything in the world changed. And with the rise of technology and social media and things as well, it's changed everything. But I guess you would have, and you know, correct me if I'm over romanticizing it, but seems like that was the last great, magical, underground, exciting, dangerous time for New York street culture, bar culture, music culture. Like the last hurrah, perhaps, for the artists and the weirdos.
Yeah, I moved there in 1990, and by late 90s, it was kind of, I don't know, New York's a weird place. It just keeps changing all the time. It's full of surprises. It's, you know, every generation keeps saying that, you know, this new shit is garbage, and, you know, and then something great comes out of that. It's a weird animal. It really is. I haven't been there since 2016, so I don't know what's really happening there right now. But I remember when I moved there in 90, and you definitely, you know, you never knew what you were going to run into. You know, what kind of a performance art thing, or there might be, you know, whoever is sitting in the bar and playing, and it was full of surprises. It was really, really incredible time and very inspiring, and you know, not only musically, but in every other way.
Do any stand out, whether they be musicians or artists or filmmakers, people around that city at that time that were really kind of, you know, creating and shaping culture and
There was this weird club called The Cooler, which was in the Meatpacking District. And that was, you know, in early 90s, if I remember right, late 90s. And it was literally kind of like Thurston Moore's living room. You know, he would come there and drink a bottle of wine and freak out on stage and with pedals and smash up his guitar and go home. You know, so it was very entertaining. And there would be these jams with like Rashid Ali, who played with John Coltrane, and William Parker Jr., the bass player, and then Thurston would go up there and freak out with them. And, you know, it was one of my, I couldn't wait for the next week, like, you know, what the fuck is going to be next? And one day I was walking on like Avenue B and 13th Street, there's this bar called, I think, Nana's or something like that. It's not there anymore, it hasn't been there for a long time, but I just saw people in there, and I'm going to check out what's happening there. And there was this guy who had set up a long table where he had about 10 boomboxes in a row. And people are sitting there. There's Jim Jones sitting in the front, and, you know, Steve Buscemi or something, you know. And this guy goes and starts recording about 2 minutes of works, nothing except for that for 2 minutes. Then he moves on to the next and does the same thing and rewinds the previous one and puts it on. And he goes through the whole fucking 10 boom boxes with only this one word, works. And he created this insane outer stellar space flight. You know, it was absolutely nuts. One of the best things I've ever seen, man. You know, I've been thinking about it. I had to rip it off that somehow, man, and do it again and, you know, buy 10 boom boxes and see if it really, you know, if I can make it work.
I love it. That's some real Tom Waitsian shit right there, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a good time there.
You're Tom Waits, man?
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, since my sister played me Swordfish Trombones in 1981, 82, it's been ever since. Yeah.
You seen him live?
No.
Me neither. That's like one of those ones that I think is just going to elude me, man. I don't know if it'll ever.
Yeah, the closest I got was the Big Time, the movie.
Right. Yeah.
Late 80s. I went to see it in a movie theater. It was pretty cool, but yeah, never had that pleasure.
He's the guy. And Joe Strummer was around New York around that time. Did you spend many nights hanging out with Joe? Did you get to know him?
I never met him. No, for some reason, because he was hanging out a lot with Jesse Malin, you know, at the Niagara and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, but I never bumped into him. It's just a shame.
Yeah. Well, and what about Eugene? You strike me as someone who would get on very well. You too. Eugene from Goggle.
Oh, hell yeah. He's my brother, man.
Yeah, yeah.
We did a bunch of gigs together in early 2000s before Goggle became that, you know, giant machine that they are. And I had my band with my wife called Madwana, and Oren, the original guitar player, he used to be the sound guy at this place called Baby Jupiter, where we would play. And I remember we had this, you know, you always think about how to, you know, soup up your show a little bit. And we met this snake handler guy who said that he has a albino cobra and all black cobra. And then we asked, like, well, can we have him at the show, you know, in the intro? And he's like, sure, I bring him over. I bring my other handler with us. And, you know, like, I can get them to come out from the baskets when he begin. And, you know, and there's maybe, I don't know, 60, 70 people. It's a small place, you know, and then we come on stage and we start playing. And then suddenly they fucking open the lids. And there comes these two fucking humongous. They were not tiny cobras. They were huge cobras out. People just fucking freaked out and ran out. We emptied the place in like 5 seconds. And then we stuck there with our instruments in our hands. And two cobras going. And we went like, that went well. So if you want to empty a place, man, you know, just hire a couple of cobras and, you know.
That's, again, I don't even know whether you could get away with that in today's world, but that is amazing. And do you think, like, because they blew up with that Start Wearing Purple song, but was that magic always there? Because they are talking about, like, the rock and the roll. Like, there's something about Eugene. There's this otherworldly alchemic magic just around that guy, even when he's off stage, just in life.
Absolutely, man. Yeah, he's a Pied Piper, man. He really is. He's that kind of dude. He has an amazing energy, and he's a very wise guy, and he's wonderful. He's a piece of work, that dude.
Yeah,
it's really funny because he's, you know, he's from Ukraine, and when he came to Finland for the first time, he came to play a festival in Finland, and he comes to us like, "Sammy, what the fuck, you know? This is exactly like Ukraine. It's like you've been under the Russian stool." It was like, yep, we were, as a matter of fact, you know, it looks very similar and all that. But I ended up, we played with the Dolls, and we had a crazy lineup for like 3 shows that we did with the Dolls. It was like stadium shows. I think it was Athens and Portugal and some other place. But it was us and Sex Pistols, Gogo Bordello, and Massive Attack. It was like,
wow.
The fuck, you know what I mean? So we were in a Porto, I think, in Portugal, and then we had a day off, and we went out with Eugene and Tommy, the bass player, took cabs and just check out different restaurants and sites and whatnot, and there came Winds of Change came on the cab radio, you know, the Scorpions, a horrible song, and I was just like, oh God, can you change the channel? And Eugene was like, no, brother, you can't change it. It's like, what? It's like, he's almost teary, and he's like, man, this song, it touches me somewhere deep, man, you know? It's like, really, the Scorpions? It's like, yeah, man, you think about it, we didn't get any fucking records, we're under the fucking Russians, man, you know, this was big stuff. The Scorpions. I love
just
that guy.
Welling up in the corner of the cab.
yeah, exactly. A whiz of change. It was just fucking one of those moments, man.
Would you ever make a record with Eugene? I think you guys would make some amazing stuff together.
You know, heartbeat. Yeah, we need to fucking get on this one.
Who else is on yours? You mentioned Nasty's on there. Who else? Or are you kind of playing most of the instruments?
Well, on the new one, it's because I started doing live gigs after that that first solo record. And so I got the guitar player and keyboard player from the band, him, the Finnish guy. Yeah, Linda is playing guitar and Burton is playing keyboards. And the drummer, who's an old friend of mine from childhood, he's still on drums. And so this record is more like built around that core, you know, musicians. And there's a couple of songs I wanted to do, the kind of the rock and roll songs on this record. I wanted them to be even more kind of just linear and garagey and really just very energy-based kind of thing, you know. And I said this in another interview, that all the people that I played with, something kind of like rubs off on you. You know what I mean? It's kind of like it leaves a mark. I played with the Helicopters for almost a year, and it definitely left a mark. And those two songs that are just like, they're fucking Helicopters in a way, you know what I mean? And I thought that, well, I got to get at least Dragon to play on them, you know. And Dragon is an old brother, and I played on his solo record, and he was really into it. So we took a ferry over to Stockholm with our engineer and recorded a couple of songs with him. And then Nasty came to play on a couple of songs, and Michael plays saxophone on the single. But that's about it. It was kind of not as many people as on the last record. Last record, I didn't really have any solid band, so I just used all my friends. I used them all.
Well, I imagine you've got a pretty impressive, you know, list of phone numbers at this point, and everybody's eager, I'm sure, to answer the call. How come it took you so long to put out a solo album? You've been in so many bands over the years. It seems like this is something that maybe would have happened earlier on, but is there any reason, or just like, were you strongholding the good stuff till it was ready?
No, I've just been very happy in the bands that I'm in. I never really, you know, saw a need for it. And when I had the band with my wife, Marijuana Stuff, I got my outlet to do other stuff through that, you know. But now when I started to kind of like, because I've been writing with Michael's band, I wrote with the Dolls, and I've been writing with other people, so I have a lot of stuff in my drawer, and I just started going through it, and I kind of realized that this is my stuff. That it doesn't fit like anybody else. It doesn't fit Michael. It didn't fit the Dolls, and I just thought that I, you know, see what happens, and I'm glad that I did. I mean, I was like what, like 58 or something when the first solo record came out.
Well, it's a good age. It's a good age to be branching out and doing your own thing. And I love, though, that you were happy with what you were doing. That is, again, contentment and peace and joy. These things are something I've been striving my whole life to try and experience and have. And I'm finally getting to a place now where I feel like I am. And it's the Holy Grail, really, isn't it? Is just like loving what you do, loving who you do it with. And if you just are in that pocket of peace and joy, then why, you know, why go chasing other stuff? It's like, I've already got everything I need and want right here. And I love that you had that self-awareness and kind of just like gratitude to just sit in it and until the time was right to step out. Love that.
Yeah, it's the road. It's not the result. It's who you travel the road with and how you travel it. That's the main thing. I've been in situations and bands where they were kind of like work, you know, like punching a clock and the set list is the same every time and all this kind of stuff. I mean, it pays okay, but at the same time, I actually rather be in working in the record store than doing that, because then the thing that I most love, which is playing, becomes something that is not that much fun anymore. It's not exciting. It's just like, you know, okay, I'm making a living out of this, which is, of course, not a bad thing, but that's not my kind of driving force. It's not that, the paycheck.
Yeah, man. Well, you want to be excited and inspired, ideally, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. In everything you do.
And The Road is almost the name of your book. The Road Bends is the name of it.
Yeah.
How did you take to, you know, the storytelling component of, you know, like, an autobiography is a big undertaking, and a life such as yours with so many nooks and crannies, trying to bring all of those stories together in a way that tells a really cohesive story, which it does. Did you enjoy the process of becoming an author?
Yeah, it after a couple of like false starts, it's this actually came out of nowhere. It was this Finnish book company who just came over to New York and, you know, rang my buzzer and, you know, asked me to do this thing. And I never even thought about, you know, writing one. And then I started thinking about it. So I enjoy sitting in pubs and telling stories. And I thought, why not put them on the paper? And their idea was at first that I get a ghostwriter and I kind of tell the story and then they write it. But we tried it twice with two different people and it just sounded like somebody else. So I thought I'd just write it myself. Then, you know, I never written books, so I had no idea what the fuck I'm, you know, getting into. So it took 3.5 years to kind of write it, you know. And at one point I realized that it's so much. And I need somebody to kind of come in and, you know, weed it out and edit it and put it into a readable format. And that's when my friend Tommy Lima, the guy, you know, the Finnish guy who kind of edited and put it together, he came in and did an amazing job in it. But the funny thing was kind of like that I carried those stories with me so many decades, you know what I mean, like a long time. And then after I wrote them, they started to erode from my memory. Seriously, I'm like, this is fucking weird, man. You know, because I realized that those stories are not at the tip of your fingers anymore, like they used to be. You know what I mean? And that the feeling of those moments, you know. And there was a couple of like moments where I had to call Michael and Nasty and like, do you remember this? Did this happen? And it's like, oh yeah, it happened. But then they tell it completely from a different point of view. You know what I mean? So I just kind of had to stay true to my, whatever it was, my perception at the time. You know, it could have been wrong, it could have been right. But, you know, it's that's how I kind of put the whole book together. And I just thought that I'd make it linear, you know, from birth to now. And it was 2015 when I kind of put it together, almost 10 years.
Yeah, there's that Japanese movie. I think it was based on the book Rashomon, and it explores the whole idea of like perspective, you know, being the defining element of truth, and every perspective is different and presents a different story. It's the same story.
Exactly.
Perspective defines the angle, and the angle is your truth.
Yeah.
When there's five guys in the mix, everybody remembers things differently, and four decades pass, and you're like, "Hey, hang on a minute, it didn't quite happen like that." And you're like, "Well, in my mind, it did." So,
yeah. And I remember there's one thing in the book where we had the meeting in the hotel with the band, and then we, you know, rolled a big fat joints, and then somebody said that the door is locked, and we were inside of this, you know, in Scunthorpe somewhere, you know, in a hotel room, and couldn't get out. Carlos went out on the ledge in the window, tried to climb to the next door window, and it didn't work. And then somebody said that, "Hey, did you check out the door? Is it open?" And it was never locked, you know, classic fucking stoner thing, you know. And I asked him, "Michael, do you remember this?" He was like, "No, man, I have no recollection." And to me, it's like fucking clear as a day. You know what I mean? Very strange shit.
I love it. I'm kind of in eternal gratitude to Tyson and the guys at Rare Bird who put out your book as well, because that he approached me the week before the pandemic. We didn't know that was coming. And we met up in London. He was over for like a book conference and everything was getting cancelled because of this outbreak of whatever was coming.
Yeah.
And so he was like, "Do you want to meet up and maybe get a drink or something? Because I want to just use this time while I'm here for some productive end." And I went to meet him just thinking maybe he'd ask if I wanted to like host a Q&A of one of his author's book launches or something like that.
Yeah.
And he was like, "I love your podcast. I've been listening to it for the last few years. You've done a bunch of episodes with our authors. Would you be interested in doing a book?" And I was like, "Oh my God, that's like my dream." Because I did English literature at university. Yeah. So I'm an English grad and had never quite put that to good use. So I was like, "Yeah, I really want to do it." And then the following week, it's like the whole world shut down. All my DJ gigs and live event hosting gigs dried up. And it was like, it felt as if a gift from whoever had really come in my hour of need. And it gave me something productive and positive to channel my energy into.
That's great.
During an insane time.
Yeah, it was insane time.
And we were in so many lockdowns, I ended up doing two.
Yeah. It was a hard time, but at the same time, I kind of look at that time in some kind of nostalgia, because it was the first time in my life that I got like slowed down, like big time, and suddenly I had time to be in a country place, for like weeks, and not really have to prepare myself for anything or go and hit the road and all that. I mean, the bank account thing wasn't that nice, but I just kept going, oh my God, And but certain aspects about it was really great, I don't mean that the deaths and all this is great, but the kind of like the quietness and the slowing down of society was something nice and something to be learned from, but I don't think we learned a thing.
Well, I hear you on that front, and I completely agree. And I found for the first time in my life a little taste of contentment and peace because of the slowing down of my life and taking stock of everything and appreciating the things I had and realizing what's important and all those things. And I think there was a collective moment when we were like, oh yeah, we all need to learn to be a little bit more unified and humble and appreciative. And then the world opened and we went, fuck it.
Fuck it.
You know?
Exactly.
And it's a beautiful metaphor. It's a beautiful metaphor for just the human self-serving greed like, and unfortunately we are a beautifully flawed species. Yeah. And I think we'll never quite learn. If we were going to, we would have already. That was maybe our chance as a species to change our ways. Exactly. And I think for a minute, we really did consider it with the best of intentions. And then it was like, fuck it, I want to go on holiday. I want to go.
Out the window.
Final thing I want to ask you about, mate, before I let you go. And thank you very much for doing this.
It's my pleasure, man.
Giving up your time. Yeah, it's been awesome. Have you got, I haven't had the chance to check it out yet, but I want to if it's available. Do you have like a travel TV series that you did?
Yes. It was on, it's actually been brought into like, I think over 20 countries, and it was on Netflix Scandinavia for a while. And I did 3 seasons of that. And we went to 18 countries too. Basically, I got the idea from, I did the Anthony Bourdain No Reservations show here in Finland. They wanted me to consult them in the beginning, and I told them I'm completely the wrong guy because I haven't lived in Finland since I was 16 and I'm not really up to their culinary habits. In my memory, the Finnish kitchen was fucking awful.
Yeah.
But they, for some reason, they insisted meeting me the second time, and then they asked me to be on camera, and I was like, well, when are you guys filming it? We're filming it around New Year's 2011 or 12, something like that. And I happened to be in Finland doing a show. So I said, sure, just get me a hotel and some food and I'll do it.
Amazing.
And while I was doing it, I just literally just thought, like, why in the hell hasn't this been done properly, just with music, because it is just this universal and space, place specific and tells the story about the culture and all that. And it's also great conversation subject, but to where you can bring out the whole society's kind of people's outlooks on societies and religions and whatnot. And it was fucking amazing. We went to 18 different countries and literally the best time. I'm so grateful for that.
It's my dream, because my favorite thing, I tour a lot as a DJ and as a Q&A host, and I go on the road a lot. And apart from the shows, my favorite thing about touring is the traveling, because when you travel as a musician, as a performer, as an artist, a creative of any type, you're immediately plugged in to the local community because of the nature of what you do. So whether it's someone who's in the local crew or someone who's coming to the show, you can just get the immediate hookup, like, oh, my friend runs this restaurant or this bar, or, you kind of have this brotherhood, this worldwide community where you can immediately get localized. And music is this thing that does unite, and travel and experiencing the world in that way is the magic of touring for me. And it's the greatest part.
And making this program, like filming it, it was because I'm a musician. The musicians in Ethiopia, in Senegal, in India, Argentina, Colombia, Jamaica, they all opened up immediately just because I'm a musician, not an interview guy. You know what I mean? It was like, you know, hey, can I check out your instrument or whatever? And I realized I'm a musician. And it just turns into a completely different vibe, the whole thing. And it's that whole experience, you know, for example, being in Jamaica and sitting like Earl Chinna Smith's yard and with, I don't know, 10 different rosters, you know, jamming with him was just insane. And he had an old jukebox next to him. And he would put it on and it's like, Sammy, can you learn this one? You know, and there comes some old Scratch Perry, you know, song or something. And I get the bass line down. And next thing you know, I'm jamming it with him and those drummers. You know, and my son's running around there, you know. And it was unbelievable, man. It was so good.
That's a blessed life right there. Can you watch it? Is it available anywhere?
I don't think UK ever bought it, but...
What's the name of the show?
It's called Sammy F. Soundtracker.
Soundtracker.
Yeah. I'm not sure if it's available now. It was on like public TV in the US for a while, and it was Netflix. And then the funny thing is that Turkey bought all the episodes except for Turkey episode.
I love it. I bet you run into these weird little moments like that, traveling and making a show about traveling, I'm sure. The bureaucracy and the red tape and the weird that all different countries have. But I think, correct me if I'm wrong, what doing something like that, especially with the filter and the lens of music being the guiding light, is that it shows that we're all a lot more, you know, similar, and we share a lot more in common than we would maybe like to believe or choose to believe. Yeah. And ultimately, at the end of the day, it's us, isn't it? It's humanity. It's a human race.
Exactly. We have all the same needs, you know. It's like, it's just a regular Joe everywhere. It's kind of like the same, you know what I mean? It's just one fucking food on the table and a roof over the head and security, and the kids are fine and can get some schooling and, you know, whatnot. But there's always the dark forces playing and trying to poke at the, you know, that other village over there. They're no good, man, you know what I mean? It's a crazy thing, man. It's kind of weird that we still haven't gotten over it. You know, it's I thought that we'd be much further in this kind of humanity business than we are by now. You know, because you think that you're making progress at some decades, and then you realize that you're taking two steps backwards. You know, it's interesting, to say the least. It's frustrating, but it's interesting.
Yeah, at least it's never dull. It's disappointing. But
yeah, they were dull. Exactly. I don't want to ever get into Brexit. You know what I mean? It's like
no way. I mean, it hits differently when I travel now, and I've got my blue British passport, and I'm so used to waddling along in the European Union line, and they're like, no. I'm like, fuck.
Now
I know how it feels, but we did it to ourselves, so we deserve what we get. In life, I think we all deserve what we get at the end of the day. Was Tony a good guy? Was he a good dude?
Oh, it was great. It was beautiful, man. I need to go and get a liver flush at the end of that week.
I didn't know of his work until he died, and the only reason I found out about his work, I completely missed the boat on it, is because almost every musician that I admire, when he passed away, did a tribute to him, you know, saying about how much they connected with him and respected him. And I was like, wow, who is this guy who knows everyone that I love?
Yeah, he was a trippy guy. It's like he was like a total music fan. And, you know, I think he's from Jersey, but he grew up in the city in New York in the 70s, you know, working in this restaurants. And he told me he used to give free meals to like Thunders and Cheetah Chrome and stuff like that. And we went to a radio station and here in Finland, in Helsinki, and they asked him to put like 10 songs together, and it could have been my 10 songs. And you know, it was like Stooges and it was Stones and it was Waits and it was all like the good shit. And it was a lot of fun. It came really out of nowhere. I didn't, you know, depression is a motherfucker, but it came. Yeah, it's sad. So sad. But, trippy guy. I had a great time with him. It was just a mad 1 week, completely insane.
Yeah, and a beautiful legacy as well. Beautiful legacy.
Yeah.
Incredible shows. Loved all of them. I've since binged all of them since discovering him.
And it's a great show. Absolutely.
Great writer. And It seems to me like you have exactly the same taste in music as me as well, Sammy. And that's kind of what drew me to Anthony is like, Ramones, Dead Boys, all that stuff, B-52s, Devo, like, you know, just all of that great punk, new wave, rock and roll you know, is the stuff of life for me. Thank you again for
thanks, everything. Man.
Thanks for the music. Thanks for the conversation. And when are you back over this side of the aisles? Do you have any plans to come back to the UK with Michael?
I think there's some talk about end of the year, some kind of a tour coming together. So we're working on it now. I'm trying to make Charlie Harper's, you know, 80th, you know, but I don't know if I can. I'm trying, but we'll see.
Talk about absolute legends right there. That dude. He just never stops. Yeah. He's still there with a can of Holsten pills in his hand, like,
crazy. He came on stage with us in Japan like two weeks ago. We did Endangered Species. He came both nights. We played in Tokyo. We dragged Charlie's ass on stage, and it was just fucking magic.
Yeah, He's the guy, man. He's the guy. Yeah. All is right with the world as long as that guy's still with us.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, listen, when you are over, I'll make sure that I get in touch with Rich and or yourself, and would love to come down and shoot another show and take some photos of you guys. And as I said, like, anybody listening or watching this who's not seen the Michael Monroe Band live, you just need to see it because it's one of the last great rock and roll lineups out there. And it's just nothing but a good time. And your solo stuff, is that something you will tour and perform live? Like, is that the plan?
Yeah, I'm doing, you know, kind of smallest tours here in Finland, but I'm trying to get next year to take it abroad. We did, for the last record, we did a short run in Spain. We did like 10 shows or something, but I'm trying to get to UK with it and do Scandinavia with it. So next year, this year seems to be kind of busy with Papu.
Amazing. Well, listen, I'm going to let you go because your dog, I think he wants out, doesn't he? He's had enough. He this interview's over. Dad, we've got the hour. Come on, let's wrap this up. Like always,
exactly to an hour, I think.
She knows. She knows. Yeah, it's so good. She's like, TikTok.
Yeah, hey, come on.
Sammy, have a great night, mate. And we'll talk real soon. And thanks again. Really enjoyed that.
Yeah, man. Thanks a lot, man.
Cheers, brother. Nice one.
Bye-bye.
So far away. I guess that I should have known.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.